the College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.
Welcome back for another week of the College Football Fix Podcast. I'm Dan Wolkin, joined by Paul Meyerberg. We're both with USA Today Sports. We both watched a lot of college football last weekend, and neither of us expected to be talking about Miami, Georgia Tech. And yet, here we are leading the show with Miami, Georgia Tech. Now, by the time you guys listen to this, I think probably the topic's gotten a little bit, I don't know if it's overkill, but it's certainly not something that has escaped a lot of people's attention, I would say. It's really one of the most remarkable things we've ever seen on a football field, the fact that Georgia Tech wins at 23-20 only because Miami did not kneel on the ball, go into victory formation, shake hands. It's all they had to do. Just snap it, kneel it. It's done deal. They win the game. They didn't do that. They turn it over. Georgia Tech goes and wins. Paul, I would like to say that it's shocking or surprising. I mean, and I guess it is, but longtime listeners of this podcast have known for quite a long time that Mario Cristobal is not very good at managing a football game. He may be good at a lot of things. He's really good at recruiting, developing offensive linemen, motivating, possibly. We can certainly lay out a lot of attributes and a lot of reasons why he makes $8 million a year coaching the University of Miami. But you know when you hire him that there's also a downside, which is that on Saturday he is frequently a disaster. And yet, even then, I could not have imagined something like this.
Yeah, this was like the worst moment that I've ever seen on a football field in my life. Like, I've never seen anything in terms of gameplay that's ever been worse than this. And I think it just comes down to this. Like, yeah, we've talked about Cristobal a lot, and it's gone from like, whoa, this is really bad, to like kind of being a gag. And then we forgot about it for a while. Then we remembered from Saturday that it really is true that he is a debacle of a coach on Saturdays. Miami wants to win national championships. It's so blatantly clear that Mario Cristobal is not capable of leading a team to the national championship because he can't even take a knee in 30 seconds left against Georgia Tech. So what are you doing? Like, why is he your coach? Why is he a coach at a major program, period, if he can't take a knee with 30 seconds left? Like, you want to win national championships at Miami. He can't take a knee with 30 seconds left against Georgia Tech. And that's really what I've been thinking about the last few days, Dan. Not to be cruel to Cristobal, who's very accomplished and obviously a very nice guy, but you cannot say to me with a straight face that you believe that this guy can lead you to a national championship when he can't have his team take a knee against Georgia Tech with 30 seconds left.
Yeah. Now, the question is just what happened and why. And look, there are certain game management issues that are just a product of it's a frenetic environment down there on a sideline. If you've ever been close to or on a sideline, there's just a lot of people, a lot of movement, a lot of guys wearing numbers. And you sometimes wonder when you see it from that perspective, like just how in the hell people pull off being as organized as they are in the first place. And yet that is what they're paid to do. And a lot of people do it. And yet this one seems pretty simple. Like you just know you're up by a score. You don't have to do anything but snap the ball and it's over. And so why don't you do that? And the answers afterwards, and even in the subsequent days, I mean, they've sort of owned it a little bit better. He and Shannon Dawson, the offensive coordinator. But it still doesn't fully explain the why. And the only thing I can come up with is just that Miami and Oregon under Mario Cristobal, he doesn't like to end a game in victory formation. Now, he has done it before. I went back and looked. You know, there were a couple times in the last few years where he has. But like this year, as an example, in zero of their wins, they've ended in victory formation. Now, look, the circumstances are a little different. They were up big in those games, and so there was no real jeopardy. But even then, like you will see a lot of coaches, a lot of teams, you know, they may be up 35-7, you know, and they keep running plays with their second or third string players in. But when it comes down to it, at the very end, at the last minute, you know, you just knee it. And, you know, even in one game against Temple earlier this year, they ran four plays in the last 90 seconds of the game, and they're up 41-7. So, like, why? What? I just think it's sort of a mentality thing with Cristobal. Like, play to the whistle, play to the last second. You know, it's that kind of macho thing, I guess. And I don't think it really has any benefit in those blowouts either, because, you know, you might get guys hurt or whatever. But I don't know. It's just, I that's the only thing I can ascribe it to, that it's not really a mistake or that it was a brain freeze. It was just sort of this intentional outgrowth of the way Cristobal handles every end of game situation.
Yeah, you know, you're right. First, real quick, there's no excuse for Miami or anyone else not to have a dedicated clock person on the sideline. And I don't even know if that's a thing, but Cristobal can pay that dude out of his own pocket and just say, hey, here's a badge. Like, your job is just to tell me what to do with the clock. You can hire an ex-coach. You can hire, like, you know, I know he's working. You can hire Randy Shannon, like a former Miami guy. Come in, Dennis Erickson, and tell me what to do with the clock. That's just real quick. But, yeah, Dan, do what this is. It's an offensive lineman. It's a former offensive lineman who coached the offensive line. And offensive linemen don't like the victory formation because there are moments in victory formation where you are just a target. You know what I mean? As an offensive lineman,
yeah. Like,
your job is just to stand there. And sometimes defenders shoot your knees. They try to snap the ball out. And you're just a target. Offensive linemen, period, don't like victory formation. I mean, they like to win, but they much rather just go forward. Let me push this guy forward 3 yards, then call it a day. That's what they want to do. So is there a mentality to it? Yes. I really do believe, hey, we're the University of Miami. We are Oregon. We're Florida International. We push guys around. That's part of it. I think another part is that Cristobal, as a former offensive lineman who coached the position, just doesn't like the victory formation. And that's it. So, and it hasn't really gotten him at Miami. Like you said, they did it against Temple because they were blowing him out. But whether you like it or not, there's just no excuse not to do it. It's there for you. It's like not. It's like refusing to do a QB sneak on 4th and inches because of this, that, or the other. It's there for you. Take it. So I want to understand, Dan, but even if we spend an hour on this podcast just trying to understand, I don't think we'd ever find an excuse, because there is no excuse.
Okay, so let's spin it forward a little bit, and then we'll move on to other topics. Do you think that this situation, just as obvious and dramatic and kind of heartbreaking for that team as it was, do you think it impacts Cristobal's standing at Miami? Like, look, they're not going to fire him over this, obviously. But do you think that there's a credibility issue that comes out of this in some way?
I do. I'd be more interested in getting your thoughts on it. But I would, that's because that's a really good question. But I do. I don't know how, like, this is a new era, right? This is an era where you need to have everybody who's committed to your program inside and out of the facility all invested on the same page. That's a lot of metaphors there. But, like, everyone has to be walking in lockstep, from your boosters to your NIL collectives to everything has to be working together. And yeah, I think the university has to support Cristobal because, like I said, he's a good coach. We both believe that. And I think he's a good person. Like, we both believe that. So he's a good guy to run a program. But if the goal is to do bigger than what you've done, this is not a moment that makes you believe that he can do it. Even though it's just a game, it's just one snap in one game out of 12 and whatever. I don't know. I have to think, Dan, that down the road that this is something that is going to linger over his head. What do you got on it?
I guess this is maybe a cop-out answer, but I think it just sort of depends what they do the rest of the year. Like, if this moment is what turns what it looked like a really good season potentially, and it starts to spiral, then I do think it lingers. I think if they rebound and end up having a really good year, then I think it probably gets brought up again, but it's not a huge deal, and they can say, hey, listen, we made adjustments. We learned from it. I think maybe, though, like, another question that's not really being asked or talked about regarding this game is why was Miami trailing Georgia Tech for most of that game? And why were they in such a dogfight with a team that, that had gotten blown out the week before by Bowling Green? It's right. Not a good team. Like, that was a horrendous loss for Georgia Tech and for Brent Key. And then they turn around the very next week and come down and they beat an undefeated Miami team. Like, to me, that's also, I mean, what was going on there?
Yeah, that's a great question that we have not, no one's asked in the wake of this. Tech completed fewer than 10 passes. They couldn't run the ball. Like, that none of the zero, if you look at a box score, zero out of 10 dentists will tell you that Georgia Tech should have won that game. Nobody, they had no business winning that game. So that is another great question that no one's asking. Georgia Tech has been so up and down to even be in that game was shocking. And not even necessarily to be in the position to win it, just to be in that game is what nobody saw coming. So, yeah, there are more issues than just one snap for Miami. And I think it's an unpredictability thing that I have to imagine is what's really ticking people off.
Well, certainly I never expected when I was leaving the Cotton Bowl Saturday, you know, about 6:30 p.m. Central Time, that we'd be leading the podcast or even mentioning Miami-Georgia Tech. I thought we would be all in on what was a phenomenal Red River rivalry game that I was very lucky and fortunate to get to see in person. And Oklahoma winning 34-30, and I will have to say, you were right. You were on Oklahoma early. And you know who else was on Oklahoma was the computers. You know, if you sort of look at the power rankings, the computer rankings, they all liked Oklahoma before this game. I didn't. I'd seen them against Cincinnati. I just sort of, you know, just sort of left me wanting. But this was an unbelievable performance by Oklahoma. And as I wrote in my column, I think it's the moment where if you're an Oklahoma fan, you can sort of leave the whole Lincoln Riley thing behind finally. It doesn't matter anymore. This was the day Brent Venables solidified himself as the right guy for the Oklahoma program, because not just because they won, but because they played in a way that, at least to me, looked like the way a Brent Venables coach team should play football.
Yeah, this is a style of football that Oklahoma fans can identify with, right, and appreciate. Like, it's a style of football where 200 and some pound, you know, safeties or 230-pound outside linebackers are stepping up and hitting 315-pound offensive linemen in the mouth and tackling guys for loss. You know what I mean? Like, this is what Oklahoma fans can appreciate. So yeah, I don't want to get any more credit than just saying about Oklahoma. I think the issue that a lot of people had, and maybe you included, was that you looked at the teams they played, and they played very bad teams in September, and it was hard to get a grasp on it. But I think that this team from the jump of this season has played, like you said, like a Brent Venables team, like a vintage Oklahoma team. And I don't know if Texas was ready for that. You would tell me. I mean, I don't know if Texas was ready for that sort of aggressiveness.
I think there was definitely,
like, responded.
Yeah, I think there was definitely some arrogance coming out of Texas before that game. I think they really thought they were the better team and were going to, I don't know about win easily or breeze through it, but they certainly thought they were going to hammer Oklahoma again, just like they did last year. But you know, from the first play or the first series, I should say, I think Texas probably should have gotten the picture. You know, I think Oklahoma was extremely well prepared from a scheme standpoint, and that had a lot to do with it. And certainly both coaching staffs, Texas and Oklahoma, devote offseason and summer to this game, to making sure they're ready for this game. But, you know, it's just one of those things where, yeah, Texas had 527 yards of offense, which you look at that and you go, did Oklahoma really play that well defensively? And yet on the eye test, I thought they played a tremendous defensive game. You know, they had a couple interceptions, which some of that blame goes to Quinn Ewers as well, and he didn't start off all that well in the game. But, you know, I think they had the goal line stand, they had sacks, they had negative plays, they were aggressive, they hit. You know, there weren't these sort of – like when Lincoln Riley coached Oklahoma – you would watch them play, and it didn't matter if it was Texas or Baylor or West Virginia or whoever. They'd get in these games, you know, and they'd have probably five plays a game where it should be a relatively benign play against them, and yet it turns into 40 yards because they're not playing fundamental football, or they're not physical or tough enough to get a guy on the ground and tackle him. And you didn't really have that. Yeah, Texas hit a couple big plays on him, and there were, you know, one or two busts. Like, that's going to happen. Texas is a great offense, not a good offense, a great offense. I mean, you watch them in person, you watch some of the, you know, the skill they've got. I mean, Jonathan Brooks is an absolute tank. You know, Xavier Worthy, Whittington, like, they have dudes at Texas. They have real dudes. And yet I thought the difference in the game was that Oklahoma's defense played better than Texas's defense. And that's not something you would ever have said about a Lincoln Riley win in a similar situation.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think it's too easy to make the Bob Stoops year two parallels. Like, it's just too easy. But the similarities are there, right? I mean, year two, a flying defense, an aggressive team that has grasped the personality of their coach, a rebound from year one. You know, I don't want to say that this team's going to go 13-0. That seems like still an impossibility. But, yeah, I mean, I just think Oklahoma, and you wrote this, at 6-0 today, excuse me, despite all the Rose Bowls, despite all the playoff berths under Lincoln Riley, they feel in a much better place today at 6-0 than they did under Riley, because there seems to be more of a consistency behind it, you know, and there seems to be more of a repeatability behind it. So I love where OU is, and I love the fact that these two teams are going to meet again, right? Because I think this was the classic matchup, and I would love for them to meet again to decide the Big 12 in a couple months.
Yeah, and that certainly leads me into what I was going to ask you next, which is, you know, Texas had a tough day. I don't think it was, you know, Sark's best day necessarily. They got off to a real slow start. They picked it up later, for sure. I think there were some penalties that derailed them. Obviously, you don't score first and goal from the one. You don't get any points. I mean, that's kind of a disaster. So there were things that Texas really left on the table in this game, and yet here they were, you know, still leading, scoring a touchdown to go ahead with a couple minutes to go until Dylan Gabriel leads Oklahoma down and does his thing. So, like, Texas is right there. And I don't think it's a stretch at all to say that if they meet again in December, that Texas would be favored again to win that game. And if they do, probably going to the playoff.
No, I completely agree. And you know, it's like, it's weird to say that, right? Because you just saw OU beat Texas, and we all saw it on TV. But there's no doubt in my mind, right? If they meet again in December, even if they're both 11-1, I think Texas would be favored. I think they'd be favored if they played again today, because you saw how good Texas is. I mean, schematically, talent-wise, you know, and there may just be a preparation, motivation, cohesiveness coming out of the locker room issue on Saturday. But yeah, this team is still damn good. And these are two really good teams, but Texas might just be simply the better team that got the better of itself on Saturday. So yeah, I'm excited to see these two. If you had to pick, obviously, which team of these two will make the playoff, I think the safer bet is to say Texas, even at 5-1.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I mean, Oklahoma's schedule is pretty favorable too. Like, I think there's a pretty good chance Oklahoma is 12-0. I mean, listen, they got UCF at home. They got to go to Kansas. I mean, that's going to be tough. That's going to be real tough.
Mm-hmm.
At Oklahoma State, you know, I don't think Oklahoma State's that good, but it's Bedlam. It's on the road. They get West Virginia at home. They got to go to BYU. They got TCU at home. I mean, look, there could certainly be a loss in there. No doubt about it. But they're just way better than I thought they were. They're just that's a really good football team. And, you know, I thought Texas is really good as well. And I know that's not what the Big 12 likes to hear at this point, because those two are leaving. And, you know, it was fascinating in that Greg Sankey was at the game and Brett Yormark wasn't, right? And that's just sort of the way it is in realignment right now. And yet Yormark is probably going to have to get up on stage in December and hand that trophy to one of them. But it is what it is. Those are the two best teams in the league.
This seems like a good time for us to transition to late Saturday night and talk about Lincoln Riley. You think so?
Yeah, go ahead.
So look, like, I watched USC play football, not on offense, but certainly on offense in the first half and for a bunch of the second half. But I watched them play defense, and it's almost, it's like watching at times. I was trying to think of a way to describe it that would be funny, right? Like, I think of certain train stations in New York City where people, there's like four trains that arrive on two different platforms, like the B and F are on one side and the Q and the R are on the other. And people like are trying to think like, do I get on this train? Am I supposed to get on the next one? Which one is this? They're getting on the platform, off the platform. That's what's watching USC's defense is like, because you will watch a play and in the bottom of your screen, you'll see some guy who's just alone, like 15 yards away from the play, who doesn't, like, what are you doing? What are you doing there? Like, are you being taught defense? Is Alex Grinch and this staff literally not speaking the same language? Are they teaching the defense in, like, Sanskrit and guys don't understand? Because I watch this team play, and that is just unbelievable how out of sorts they are on the defensive side. And I had read what you had written hours and hours earlier about Venables and Riley. And then I watched this game, and I'm like, yeah. Like, an OU fan is having a blast right now watching USC struggle against Arizona. The dichotomy, the juxtaposition had never been more clear than what you wrote about on Saturday. It was absolutely disastrous to watch that game. And I don't know how you have that team in your top 15, even at 6-0, because they seem like a mess.
Yeah, I think, like, you almost have to go back to the beginning with Lincoln Riley. So he gets the job, the head coaching job at Oklahoma. Stoops retires, surprisingly. And, you know, they're obviously extremely talented, and they've got, you know, they've got the quarterback thing rolling. They got Baker, and, you know, he goes and plays Georgia in the Rose Bowl, and they almost win, right? They almost win. Their defense melted down in the second half of that game after they got a big lead. But we didn't really, you know, like say, man, you know, they're never going to win anything. It was just kind of like, yeah, that was unfortunate. They need to get a little bit better defensively. You know, then the next year they go back to the playoff. You know, again, it's a year where they lost a game they shouldn't have lost. I think Kansas State, maybe. Mm-hmm. No, that was the year they lost to Texas, 48-45. Sorry. But they go beat Texas in the rematch, and they go play Alabama, and they get their doors blown off again. And you go, well, you know, it's Alabama. What are you going to do, right? Then the next year, that's when they lost that early game to Kansas State. And that's 48-41. You know, couldn't stop them. I think they even had maybe like a two-score lead. And you kind of and that's the one that kind of makes you go, yeah, they're not really getting a lot better on defense, are they, right? And then they go back to the playoff, and they got smoked by LSU, like bad, embarrassingly bad. Right. And then you come back the next year, and, you know, and that was the COVID year. So, you know, whatever, like there was a lot of weird stuff that's going on, but they lose again to Kansas State. Couldn't stop them. They lose to Iowa State. Right. And now it's a thing. It's a real thing. Like, they are not good defensively, and they're probably not getting, and they're not really getting a whole lot better. And so, like, at that point, you know, back in like 2020, I think you would, if you're Lincoln Riley, you should have gone, hey, listen, like, we need to do something dramatic here, because this is not cool. What's happening to us. And now it's almost like, I don't even want to say it's sad, but it's just so frequent and so often, you know, what's happening, you know, what it looks like, you expect it. And if they don't get to the playoff with Caleb Williams, like, what would this team be without him? I sort of shudder to think about that.
It would be a disaster. And look, I think the important point you're making, or the important point to take away from what you're saying, we know it. Like, we know that USC is going to do this. But more importantly, every opponent that they play knows it too. Like, Arizona went into that game, and credit Jed Fish and his staff for, like, maximizing this energy level. But they went into that game knowing, like, essentially, and I hate this cliche, but if we hit USC as hard as we can, on plays 1 through 5 and set a tone for this game, like, we can push them around. Like, we can put them in an uncomfortable position. You know what I mean? So yeah. Arizona knows that. Oregon knows that. And we mentioned it last week, like, Oregon, Notre Dame, Washington, Utah, like, these teams know it. And they're going to do the same exact thing to USC. So, like, in the big picture, let's see how the year goes out. But you can say now what you just mentioned. It's very obvious. If you don't have Caleb Williams on this team, and no disrespect to the kid, he's just no Caleb Williams, but if Jackson Dart is still your QB at USC, this is not a good situation. Because Caleb Williams is a magician. And if he's not around, I don't know where USC is at. Even with him there, I don't know how in your mind you think that this team is going to do more than 9-3. Because there's just too many tough games left on the schedule and too many teams are just licking their chops. You know, offensive coordinators, quarterbacks, linemen licking their chops at the chance to play USC. So if this season, going back, like you mentioned, back to the Rose Bowl, to Kansas State, to Iowa State, and now to Arizona, this season doesn't spark some change in Lincoln Riley, it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. That's just something I think to watch going into December, January. If he doesn't, like, take a step back and clearly state, like, here's how we're going to change things, then as an SC fan, just get used to it, you know, just like Oklahoma fans did. You're going to lose a game you shouldn't. You're going to look bad doing it. And you're not going to have the toughness that you need to have as a defense and as a team overall to win a national championship. That's just it. That's just a Lincoln Riley coach team at this point.
Yeah, look, football has changed. It's not the 1970s anymore. We know that. It's a more skilled, finesse game in a lot of ways. Offenses have huge advantages. The play calling, all of the rules, all of it. But fundamentally, it is still a sport where you have to have a certain baseline level of physicality to win at the highest level, and you've got to be able to stop somebody sometime. And I just don't feel like Lincoln, I mean, does he just not get it, or does he not believe it, or just doesn't know how to do it? I don't know, but it is troublesome. I think it's really troublesome given what they've invested in him and what you should be doing at a place like USC.
Yeah, just put USC on a field against Michigan right now. Okay?
Oh, bloodbath.
Just don't bring your children. Okay? And watch that game. That would be an atrocious, atrocious, atrocious result for USC in that type of game. So that's it. That's all you got to say.
All right. Is Marcus Freeman edging toward trouble?
So let's like think about when he was hired, right? We both agreed at the time, and I think everyone agreed, that this was a hire made aware with the knowledge that there were going to be some speed bumps for a first-time head coach, a young guy. It was basically an investment in Marcus Freeman, and I still believe that that investment makes sense because I believe that he's a good leader of younger men. He's a good recruiter, and that he'll grow into the job. So we knew that going in. Nonetheless, Dan, like, yes, you can't have what happened on Saturday and say anything less, or then go back to Duke and realize that they needed to go 95 yards to beat Duke, or then go back to Ohio State and that they had 10 guys on the field and lost to Ohio State. Like, you're starting to see a combination, a compilation of things that makes me think that, yeah, like, how could he not be under a little bit of a spotlight right now, right? Like, how could he not be, even taking into account what we mentioned in the beginning?
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying, and it's such a weird sliding doors moment because I think we both probably agree that if Cincinnati hadn't made the playoff that year, or I guess potentially if Notre Dame was willing to wait, Luke Fickell probably would have been the head coach at Notre Dame and not Marcus Freeman. You know, and I don't know if that would look better, if that would look worse than where it's at right now. Notre Dame felt they had to get that thing filled. They couldn't wait a couple weeks for Cincinnati to lose that semifinal game because of recruiting and all the stuff that happens when you have a vacuum at head coach. So yeah, it's in some ways it's an unfair spot to put him in. It's also a massive opportunity, and I don't think it's been awful, but there's certainly been games where you're looking at it and the record isn't as good as it should be. I think they need to have patience. I hope they have patience, but let's see what happens this week. I mean, they've got USC. I mean, this has been a tough stretch for them. Ohio State, Duke, Louisville, who's obviously way, way better than anybody knew, and then now USC. I don't know what they have left in the tank, but if they have the same sort of pride and love for their head coach that they have had in the offseason and in social media and all and stuff like that, I need to see a good game out of Notre Dame this weekend.
Yeah, I agree. I don't want to see them lose 48-14 because that's gonna make it a little bit different. But I don't want Notre Dame to be duplicitous. I mean, they gave Brian Kelly a number of chances. I understand Brian Kelly hit early, but they were patient with Brian Kelly as he reinvented things. For a couple of years of 8-5, they went 4-8. So I don't like that's not. Yeah, I think we're being good about this and not being overly dramatic. Like, let's not be to the point where we're saying he's got to win Saturday or else he's going to lose his job. No. It is not even in close to the realm of possibility. I think it's more about, like, public opinion to me, you know? And, like, what does 5-3 look like for Marcus Freeman if it's a bad loss, you know? And what is the tenor of things around, not inside the building, but in the fan base and in the supporters of the program? That's what I'm more interested in. But he's not coaching for his job. I do think that he's got the leash to see this through for quite a bit more time. But yeah, let's not get blown out. I think that's not that happened for Marcus.
Okay. So Texas A&M loses to Alabama. I really did not get to watch any of this. I don't know what more to say other than from everything I've gathered, you know, kind of Alabama played the way Alabama's been playing, which is it's not pretty. It's a little bit chaotic. It's not great, right? But because of their talent and because they do have a very good defense, they're able to win a game at A&M that really drops A&M out. And I think it's not so much it's the losses, it's the results. But it's also like Jimbo's, you know, I mean, he's sitting there talking about it afterwards about, you know, a lot of football left and, you know, kind of like putting a super happy face on it. I mean, they've lost to two good teams. The only two good teams they've played this year. And this was a major opportunity to beat Alabama that they didn't take. And, you know, he doesn't go for 4th-and-1 in a tie game in plus territory, but he comes in afterwards at the press conference as well. If it was half a yard, I probably would have gone. Like, what are we doing here?
It's so funny. Yeah, this felt like an NFL game, Dan. Like, in the way it was played, the way it was coached, the way it was treated afterwards by Jimbo, it felt like an NFL game. Obviously, an inferior NFL game. And we know what Alabama is now. This is the way that they're going to play. This is what Saban's going to do. And gosh, if he gets this team to 11-1, which is conceivable, it could happen. It's just going to be an incredible coaching job by him, like, to get this team to 11-1. But obviously the story is A&M, and I think A&M's cautiousness, their unwillingness to even, like, try to take the game away from Alabama instead of just letting Alabama give it to them. These are the troubling things that you've noticed about Fisher for years that you hoped would evolve, but clearly he has not evolved. So bottom line, at 4-2, like you said, they've lost to the two teams that have a pulse on their schedule. So when he says things like there's a lot of football left to be played, if I'm an A&M fan, I'm like, are you sure? Can we just stop right now? Like, I don't want to play the rest of the SEC schedule. I don't want to go 7-5 because this team is just, it's just tired. The whole thing is tired, Dan. Like, you watch this team play and it's just so tired. Like, this team plays in standard definition. It's so boring.
I don't even want to talk about them, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I agree. They're just boring.
But and what's funny is, like, okay, if I were Jimbo Fisher, you know, he's got a $95 million contract. He's won a national championship. What he's been doing has not really been working that well. Like, if I'm him, I just sort of let it ride at this point. Like, what do you have to lose? You know, okay, they fire you. So what? Like, you're still getting your $95 million, and probably some other dumb school will hire you in a year. Like, I don't, I don't understand why he's just so tight and conservative that way when, you know, at least be sort of interesting and entertaining. Take some chances. It's not going to affect your livelihood one way or the other at this point. That's right. What I don't get.
For sure. If I knew that I could do whatever I wanted and was still going to get $95 million, I would let it ride. I'd let it rip. I would let it rip. Pay me or whatever. But no. Win or lose, you're still going to pay me. So yeah, he needs to let it rip. That's just not Jimbo style.
Yeah.
He just doesn't want to let it rip.
All right. So Ohio State, it was a close game. They beat Maryland. LSU comes from behind at Missouri. That takes one undefeated team off the board. Georgia looked like the real Georgia against Kentucky. Mark Stoops had a comment on his radio show, on his coach's show last night on Monday night, where he talked about, you know, and I'm finding the quote here, but okay, he said fans have that right to complain. I just encourage them to donate more, because that's what those dudes are doing. I can promise you, Georgia, they bought some pretty good players. You're allowed to do that these days. We could use some help. All right, let's unpack this a little bit. I don't think he means that as a shot at Georgia.
No.
But and I understand what he's doing, which is he's trying to use this as sort of a motivation for Kentucky fans to, you know, open up their pockets and give to the collectives and stuff like that. But I do think, like, you know, some people have interpreted the backlash to this comment as having, you know, NCAA enforcement brain still, and we're still sort of in that era of, ooh, you're buying a player, or, you know, you can't do that. I think it's more that we have a brain that's conditioned to believe, you're the head coach. You're in charge of recruiting. That's your responsibility. That's your job. It's more than 50% of your job. Like, why are you putting that on us? You're the one who's getting paid $9 million.
Right.
And I do think like that's one of the things you're seeing, or you're going to see more and more from some of these coaches who are frustrated or who lose games like this, is be like, well, what do you want me to do? Like, they have better players, and they have better players because they put more money into players. So, you know, but Georgia's been kicking Kentucky's ass for 20 years. So nothing in that respect has changed. I just think this is sort of – this comment just to me shows how unsustainable the current state of affairs is. Because, yeah, if you're a fan, you're like, dude, we're paying you $9 million. Mm-hmm. You're saying we need to do more? No.
Yeah, it's a crazy sentence for people who have spent a long time in this sport or watching this sport, no matter what. To hear a coach say that still is like, you got to wrap your head around it, you know. So there is an aspect of it, but this is just the new excuse. Like, I've heard 3 or 4 coaches say that this year already after a loss. You know, look at their roster. We need to have more support. We need to have more money, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just the newest thing. It makes it feel really, like, antiquated, but it wasn't that long ago when people were saying dumb things like, you know, we need to look at their facilities. We need to have better facilities. You're like, now you look back at that, you're like, wow, that's stupid. But it's just the newest thing. And you know what? You're exactly right. You're the University of Kentucky. You don't lack for cash. You don't lack for boosters. You're Mark Stoops, who we really like as a coach, who's done a great job. You're making $9 million a year. Don't make these stupid excuses. Just don't. It makes you look dumb. The truth is, like you said, Kentucky's been getting their ass beat by Georgia for a couple generations now. It had nothing to do back then with NIL. It's got nothing to do with it now. Georgia's just a better program, okay? So don't blame the players. Also, like just popped in my head, when you say that, you're essentially telling your own team, we need better than you. I don't get that. I really don't get that.
Yeah, that's probably not the best thing to say either. All right, let's move on to this week. It is not a week with a lot of ranked versus ranked, but there are a couple huge ones. Start with Oregon at Washington, the two who are headed for the Big Ten next year, who, much like the Big 12, it seems like the two best teams in the Pac-12 are those. And it's going to be a very unhappy trophy ceremony to hand it to you know, Oregon or Washington who kind of stuck the final knife in to the Pac-12, but it is what it is. Washington's at home. Washington, by the way, a new athletic director, Troy Dannon from Tulane, replacing Jen Cohen. That's a good hire for Washington. And he will certainly have his hands full with a lot of the things going on there. But what do you think? I mean, Washington, we have not seen as much of them in big spots as we have Oregon, because we you know, not that Colorado was good, but it was a game everybody was watching. We saw what they did there. But this is by far the best team they've played as well. So what do you think?
I think this is a fantastic game. Two of the top six or seven teams in the country. I'm just going to take Washington because it's at home. That's really the only reason, because I think these are two very evenly matched teams. I think Oregon is probably the better team. Like, I like what I've seen out of Oregon more than I like out of Washington. I really liked Washington. But I'm going to take the Huskies just based on the fact that that environment is tough. So two best teams in the Pac-12 for me very easily. And I do think Oregon can lose this game and still get into the playoff, because the Pac-12 is this good and will have this kind of reputation with the committee down the line.
Yeah. But what do you think is going to happen?
Oh, well, I think this is a high-scoring game. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, this is a high-scoring game. I think Oregon is more comfortable getting in this position where they can lean on their defense and be physical. Like, if this game, or if Oregon got into a game against an opponent, like in January, where it was going to be 24-20, 27-21, I like Oregon a lot more in that environment, because, like you said, we've seen them maybe not against the best teams in the country, obviously, but we've seen them on a big stage with a lot of eyeballs. And they've played the style of football that I think they want to play. And I think a year into Dan Lanning, that's kind of who they are. They're like kind of a physical team. Like, they want to be a physical team, and they want to play that physical game, like a Big Ten game traditionally. So in that situation, in that setting, I would like Oregon a lot. And I'm not going to say that they can't make Washington play that game, because they very clearly can. But Washington has this ability a lot, and we've kind of made this reference maybe once or twice so far this year. They're a lot like the Burrow LSU team, in that you will be 14-7 with 8 minutes left in the second quarter. And they have this really unique ability, and might not be matched in college football this season, to score 21 points in 8 minutes, or 21 points in 6 minutes, like touchdown, three and out, touchdown, turnover, touchdown, like boom, boom, boom. So that's what scares me about Washington if I'm Oregon, is that you can make the game your game. Like, you can be up 17-3 at halftime, and then you'll look up going to the fourth, you'll be down 24-17, because Washington has that spark. So Arizona kind of bottled up Washington, kind of, and Oregon might be able to do the same, but I just think that in that setting, in their comfort zone, like, Washington wins this game because they have that jolt of offense in a short period. So if this game gets into 38-35, that's the game Washington wins, and I think that it gets there.
Yeah, I'm inclined to go Washington just because of home field advantage. I think in a game like this, it's key. I think it's going to be it's a tough place to play. I mean, I've been there before, and it's obviously going to be packed to the hilt. It's going to be an awesome environment. So yeah, I kind of think Washington is where I lean as well. We touched on Notre Dame USC. I mean, if you just sort of go off track records and what the teams have been, I think I just have to go Notre Dame, that they're going to be tougher. And it's going to be the day where Sam Hartman throws for 400 yards and Notre Dame's going to win. I don't know if it's any more complicated than that.
No, I agree. This does feel like a game where Hartman, like, goes 33 for 47 for 425, four touchdowns, no picks. Because that's what a lot of QBs do against SC. You know what I mean? So it feels that way to me. Like we mentioned with Notre Dame earlier, like, they just need to bully USC to win this game. I mean, that's what everyone's got to do. They just got to bully them. So maybe Hartman doesn't throw the ball 47 times, like, he won't need to. But yeah, they need to be the physical team. They need to be the team that, like, sets the tone early. USC, I don't know. They're 6-0. They have Caleb Williams. Notre Dame's 5-2. They've been struggling to put teams away pretty much all season. I don't care. Like, I don't know how you pick USC to win this game. Clearly they can win this game. But I just don't know how you pick them. I just don't know how. So Notre Dame, with all their flaws, I picked to win this one.
I agree. All right, North Carolina, Miami. It's in Chapel Hill. What do we think? Are the Canes going to bounce back here?
No. And I think, you know, I don't know how you feel about North Carolina. Like, I was, Eric Smith and I were like messaging a little bit about Carolina on Saturday. And I was like, I feel like we don't talk about them, but that's also the right amount to be talking about them. Like, I don't really know what they're about, but I do know that the offense is better than I thought they'd be. I really was wondering if this offense would still be electric, and they're still pretty good. Drake May is still really damn good. So I would take North Carolina in this game, not because Miami blew it against Georgia Tech, but I just think North Carolina might just be the better team. They might just be the better team. So I'm taking NC in this one.
Okay. UCLA at Oregon State. I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time, but
this is going to be a physical game. UCLA's defense is awesome. Oregon State is physical too. So yeah, low scoring, 14-7, 14-10.
Yeah, UCLA needs that defense to be awesome because they are not awesome on offense.
Yeah, they're rolling with Dante Moore, and God bless him. I mean, and he's going to be a good one. You kind of get the impression, like, so he threw the ball 44 times on Saturday. Maybe like 4 to 8 of those, you were like, okay, like, whoa, like, here we go. So, like, you can see it, but they're going to have to ride this defense. You're right. UCLA is not going to win the Pac-12, and it might not look that much better in the standings. But to me, like, if they can get through this year and win 9 games with this QB and this offense, like, yeah, that's a really good sign.
I will probably check in on Missouri-Kentucky Saturday night just to kind of see how both teams bounce back. Don't need to talk about it a ton, but, I mean, Missouri's just been an interesting team because they were 5-0. They had an opportunity to win that game against LSU and couldn't get it done. I think this is going to be the game that kind of determines the course of the rest of their season. I think it's a real coin flip. I think this one's a total – just play it 10 times, it goes right down the middle.
Yeah. And Missouri's offense is really good. Like, I understand they played LSU, but this is becoming a theme. So I'm higher on this team after LSU, despite the loss. Yeah, you're right. Like, this is probably for third place in the East, you would think. So there's some stuff on the line, a pretty premier bowl bid potentially. So interesting matchup of two teams that aren't really going anywhere, but could end the year in that 22-25 range if things play out well in the coaches' poll.
Yeah, not too much else really though to talk about. I think A&M's at Tennessee, which is the CBS game. Like, if A&M loses this one, I think it starts to get really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think they probably will lose this one. Let's just get prepared.
Let me give you another one that I think is going to have some impact, which is West Virginia at Houston. And the reason I bring this up is, first of all, West Virginia, which we haven't talked a lot about, is 4-1.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, very much still in the thick of this thing in the Big 12 up to this point. I mean, their only loss was to Penn State, so they're undefeated in the league. Dana Holgorsen used to coach at West Virginia. He left to go to Houston. They're 2-3. They're at home. If they lose this one at home to West Virginia, I think the clock is really ticking on Dana Holgorsen. And, you know, sort of based on things I've heard lately, you know, they play Texas at home on the 21st. Mm-hmm. If those two games go badly, that might be the end.
Yeah, Houston needs a reboot. So, I mean, he's going to get a nice little chunk of change to walk away, so no tears. But they need a reboot. And West Virginia, they know who they are. Like, if you get a chance to watch them Saturday, they do not try to be anything except for who they are. And I love that about a team. They stay in their lane, they win ugly, and that's just who they are. So I get the feeling that they could do to Houston what they've done to a couple teams. Win an ugly, ugly game, like 24-13. And that's just West Virginia for you.
All right, kind of a bad weekend in the Big Ten. I mean, Iowa at Wisconsin is the highlight game. Don't really have much interest in watching that one, though. So, yeah, I think that's going to be the weekend. All right. So we'll wrap it up here. thanks to Eric Smith, our college sports editor, USA Today, who is sitting in, and Paul Meyerberg. I'm Dan Wolkin. This has been the College Football Fix presented by USA Today Sports. Until next week, enjoy it. Be safe, everybody.
The College Football Fix Podcast. With Paul Meyerberg and Dan Wolkin. This is the College Football Fix Podcast from USA Today Sports.